Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm saying that correctly. I am the host of this humor-adjacent medical podcast called The House of Pod. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us whenever you join us. I appreciate that. Today, two people I am very excited to speak to, and I'm very excited to have them speak to each other and then watch them speak to each other and then sometimes speak to me. First, let's start with returning guest, Tema Fudge. Tema, it's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
How are you, buddy?
You know, I'm living life. I'm doing okay. I'm not in the United States, so things are going well.
It's going well because you're not in the United States is what I'm hearing. Like, you're happy to not be here where I am. I got it. I'm not going to argue with that. It's hard to argue with that. Tell me where you are.
I am currently in Malaysia, but I'm going to be in Thailand tomorrow. Well, technically later today here. So
what time is it over there? Because it's like 8 a.m. ungodly early, even for a doctor. But for podcasting, this is crazy early. So what time is it over there?
It is past midnight. It's almost 12:30 a.m. here in Malaysia.
Oh, my God. So you're trooper. How is the food? I love Malaysian food. I love it.
It's been good. I feel like I've gotten a good tour because I've gone country to country. So it's been a lot of good food for the past how many weeks? So it's been good.
This is just a vacation. This is just for fun. You're not like doing a peacekeeping mission or something like that.
Oh, no. This is just like me dissociating from like life. So.
Oh, good for you. I've never been more proud of you than this moment. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about you, but first I want to introduce our other guest, who I'm very excited to have on. It's his first time here, Josh Trebach. He is an ER doctor and a toxicologist. Josh, welcome to the show, buddy.
Hey, thanks, man. Happy to be here.
Josh, I want to get to what a toxicologist is. I want to talk to you about that, but first... there's something that I want to talk to Tema about, and I think you can weigh in on this because you're closer to it than I am. Tema, there's a big day coming up in your life soon, is there not?
Yes.
It's not a wedding, as far as I know.
No.
Is there? Are you getting married? Are we breaking news here?
Oh my God, congratulations.
No. I'm getting married to a hospital program, technically.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this Wednesday, so December 14th is the match, well, military match, let me specify. The match, for anyone who doesn't know, is basically the process that people go through to figure out like where they're going to go for residency. You apply, you get interviews, and then you rank places. Because I'm an HPSB, so I had like this scholarship through the Navy, I have to do both the match through them, and then also do the civilian regular match that everyone knows about. But for military, we find out sooner. So, yeah, that's pretty much what's happening.
What is HPSP? I'm sorry.
Ooh, it is Health Profession Scholarship Program.
Oh, wow.
Don't quote me if that is incorrect.
No, that makes sense. That's close enough. I'll buy that. That's good.
But basically, it's the scholarship that the Army, Air Force, and Navy have for medical students at civilian schools. So basically, like regular medical schools. So they help pay for your schooling. In return, you serve as a physician with them for however many years you have afterwards. So I initially didn't do it my first year med school. Then I saw how many loans I owed, so I did it second year. Because of that, you can apply to residency, and they have their own residency program. So the Navy has four, so for family medicine.
So soon you're going to find out the place and people you're going to be connected to for at least 3 to 4 years. So it's kind of like a marriage, but probably longer than most American marriages.
Yeah. It's actually really interesting because I did like all my sub-I's this summer, and all of them were at Navy institutions. And because like the Navy family medicine community is so small, it's like these are all people who at least 6-7 years I'll be working with, because it's not just residency, but also afterwards is when my commitment starts. So yeah, I'm just excited to know where I'll be moving.
You're excited and nervous, I'm assuming. Is there some places that you might end up where you're like, I really, really hope it's not that place? Or are all of them pretty acceptable to you at this point? You don't have to say which is which.
All of them I think I would be okay living at. I think there are some more than the others, like the East Coast ones I'd rather be at, just due to family proximity. I haven't lived near family since high school, basically. So it'd be nice to live near my family. Or at least like extended family. So yeah, it's just a matter of there's where I really, really want to go, and then everywhere else I'd be happy being. So I'm just excited to learn where I can like start looking for apartments and if I will be near my grandparents.
It's always the most interesting thing, because I remember when I was waiting for match day, and I was just doing this civilian match, which is in the third week of March, I believe. And I remember being like, okay, so starting in late March, I will have to figure out where I'm moving, if I'm moving, how I'm going to afford XYZ. And it's like my recollection from this, hasn't been that long, but it's like a binding contract, right? Like you go through the match, you have to go where you match. And so it's very interesting. I don't think a lot of us, we've been in like, you know, we haven't been in these environments where someone tells us on the end of 1 month that we were supposed to uproot everything and move somewhere, like surprise. And yeah. I don't know, there's a lot of emotions on match day too. I remember for me, our school let us, you know, again, this not to get too off topic, but it's always very interesting to me on like how the match day results are like given. I think if you like watch TV or you see the news reports, sometimes people will be like on a stage or whatever. It's very, I don't know. I have personal thoughts on how I think match days should go.
Go on. We have no agenda.
Kaveh, I don't know how it was for you and Tema. I don't know what the setup is going to be for you as well, since you're going to be a part of both essentially. But for me, when I was in med school and waiting for the match, we all got together like as a university or a med school, and then we got envelopes and we were able to sit with our like families and our friends and open it in privacy, I guess, with them, like in a large room. But I see and hear stories about my colleagues who have had to go on stage one at a time and like read out in front of everyone. And I don't know if I would, but some people really like that. I don't know. For me, it's a huge thing, right? Like sometimes you get to go where your number one was. Sometimes you're going to your number like ninth or 10th spot, which is acceptable as well. I mean, like you rank those spots, and I feel like it would just be so stressful. Like so I was so thankful in retrospect, but I don't know. I think it's probably just like different med school cultures that lead to what it currently is, but it makes me so stressed by proxy. I don't know. Stressed by proxy to hear about people having to go on a stage. and like saying where they're going in front of everyone. I was like insulated in a bubble of like my partner and my like parents and my brothers. So I was like very like cozy. I don't know.
I totally agree. I think that would be nerve. I did not enjoy the way we did it either. It wasn't quite that dramatic. We like had a big room. Everyone got their package, but then, you know, everyone's walking up to everyone else asking them like, oh, so where'd you end up? What'd you do? Which is like, I think great for most people, but there are some people who are not going to the place they were hoping to go to. And that's a hard day,
yeah.
You know, cause you're spending the next 4 years or whatever at a place that you
or six.
Yeah. Where in a place that you may not really want to be, you know, and you may feel a little bit of embarrassment. You may feel a little bit of shame. I mean, there's a lot of emotions to work through there. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's not the first time med school has done something weird.
What?
So that's kind of why I decided to travel. Cause I was like, I want to be by myself.
Yeah.
When I get that like batch email. And then yesterday I was like, actually, maybe I do want people around me, even if virtually. But yeah, it's, I know my med school, I think they're planning to change it for this year because there's been so much like backlash kind of about the fact that like we don't want to open up our envelopes on the stage in front of everybody, especially it's like, I'm not cool with all of y'all like that. Like, I may not want you all to know that. So yeah, I don't know. The way people do match is very interesting. I think the one good thing that came out of like pandemic match days is people got to do it like in their homes by themselves or with like their close friends. But other than that,
Yeah.
I hear you.
Well, for all our listeners out there going through the match, I hope that you end up at a place that you're happy about. If it's not your number one choice, trust me, it's going to pass before you know it. You're going to thrive and do great there. And I have complete faith in you and sending you all my love, because I know what that day is like. So let's change gears, because I do have specific toxicology questions here for Dr. Treebach. Josh, let's start with some of the basics. Just what is toxicology and what's a toxicology fellowship? Like what does that entail? Do you have to, does that mean you're just like, you know, you read an extra book or two about like plants that are poisonous, or you have to learn about snakes? Is it like a 3-year program? What is it?
Sure. So, dude, I wish it was just reading one extra book. That would be so nice. Medical toxicology is a relatively big field. I'll start with, so the path to being a medical toxicologist in the, at least here in the United States, is after you go through medical school training and then residency training, be it in pediatrics or internal medicine or psychiatry or most commonly emergency medicine, you apply for a medical toxicology fellowship, which is actually a match process as well, like we were just talking about. And then that once you match into that, that's a 2-year program. So 2-year fellowship program. Well, some fellowships are longer, some fellowships are shorter, but for medical toxicology, it's 2 years. And so during those 2 years, you're essentially studying all the things that a medical toxicologist does and needs to know. And it's a very big, very big field. In general, if I were to sum up some of the topics in medical toxicology, so for example, it's like saying like surgery, like what do you do? It's like a huge field. I mean, you can, right?
Great question. What do they do, those bastards? What do they do?
There's so much you can say. What I'll do is I'll say in the realm of medical toxicology, it's studying the effects that anything external to the body, sometimes people say drugs, sometimes people say pharmaceuticals. The correct term technically is something called a xenobiotic, which is anything external to the body that's not produced in the body or by the body, really, something external that can cause toxicity. So any sort of toxicity from a drug or a substance or an animal or a plant or something man-made, something natural, any sort of toxicity, any sort of withdrawal from drugs, substances, things like that, public health threats or disasters, and then just providing general information to the public and to our colleagues, I think is a good way to sort of sum it up.
Yeah, no, that's good. I love Xenobiotic. It sounds very James Cameron. I'm into it. What brought you to the field? What drew you to it?
Yeah. So I mean, the short answer is that it is just so much fun. But the longer answer I would say is in med school and even in college, I think if I were to think back, I really liked the pathophysiology of medicine and just of science. And so, you know, I think I was always asking, like, why does a cell do this? We remember this for the test, but why does a cell do this? Why does a disease cause these symptoms? Why does this drug do what it does? It's the pathophysiology. And for me, that's been the most interesting part of medicine. And toxicology at its core is understanding that pathophysiology and then applying it. And that can be with respect to all those topics I was just saying, plants, mushrooms, animals, drugs from a doctor, drugs from a friend, drugs from made in a lab. It can be sort of anything. And it's really interesting because in the world of toxicology, we don't have as much robust data that some of these other fields in medicine do. So for example, if someone gets pneumonia, I can tell you, you know, what the typical course of that pneumonia is. And we have data to say which types of pneumonias are worse and which infections are worse, et cetera. But in the world of toxicology, we don't really have a lot of that because it's hard to study. You can't really take a group of people and poison them and see what happens as a rabbit. Yeah. that is frowned upon, and I do not condone that. So we don't have a lot of information. So you're relying a lot on that pathophysiology. So if I have a patient or I receive a consult or a call at the poison center from someone who was exposed to a drug that was made in a lab that we know nothing about, I have to rely on that pathophysiology and my understanding of the drug and even being a bit of a nerd and looking at the structure of the compound or whatever to try and see what those effects would be. So it's very fun.
So you like the fact that's not quite so linear. It's not like, oh, you have A disease. That means you have to get B treatment for C length of days. You kind of like that you are figuring things out as you go along. Am I reading that correctly? Yeah.
You are simultaneously navigating that space between mystery and application to help your poisoned patient. It's very exciting for me, and it's very fulfilling. And then, you know, there's other fantastic reasons that I love toxicology. You know, there's this huge public health mission. You know, we have poison centers that serve a lot of the states here in the USA and provide information, not just to the public, but, you know, to the hospitals as well. Anyone can call a poison center and talk to them, do a lot of fighting misinformation, addressing the sort of conspiracy theories. I think fentanyl has been something that's been in the news a lot lately. So I think it just, at the end of the day, helps me be a better physician for my patients, and the world could always use more toxicologists. So that's my spiel.
Well, it's a good plug. It's a good plug.
I was going to ask, you kind of brought it up. So this is just my ignorance and just being like the med student that's been told to call like poison control on a patient. So when we call poison control, we're not talking to a toxicologist, but do they contact you all and then kind of figure things out and then kind of relay the information back to us?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. And TBH, I was not even sure how this fully worked until I was a tox fellow. So in general, in the USA, there's a bunch of poison centers. Not every state has one. Some states are covered by nearby poison centers in other states. But in general, a lot of there's going to be a poison center that is covering a state. At the poison center, the phone lines themselves are run by what we call spies, not like Russian spies, but like specialists in poison information. Individuals will answer the phone and they will take the calls, and they're trained to, you know, answer those calls. And they're usually they can be a nurse, they can be a pharmacist, and they answer tons of these calls. And I worked alongside of these individuals when I was a fellow, and, you know, they were like in the room right next to me, taught me so much. I'm so thankful. But those specialists in poison information will answer the call. They take a lot of those calls from the hospital. They can be from home. When I was a kid, my brother swallowed a battery and my mom called Poison Center. We don't, oh, the GI crossover, GI crossover.
Yeah, I'm listening. You have my interest. I'm listening.
Crossover episode. What? But I remember my mom told me she called Poison Control. And, you know, so it's all sorts of stuff that you can call. And the Poison Control specialists always will have a medical director as their backup. And that's going to be a medical toxicologist, which is technically what I am now. So I, in my current position that I am now, I do work closely with multiple poison centers. And so I am sometimes that person that gets called by the spies with questions or tricky cases. And then on top of all of that, certain hospital systems have direct toxicology consults. So you can actually say, you know what, I want to call the medical toxicologist directly who's affiliated with our hospital and have them come in and see the patient. So I sort of can get, there's two avenues to get to a medical toxicologist, either through the poison center, if that's where they also work, and then through like direct sort of consultation, if that's something your hospital system sets up. So it's a little bit complicated to understand. Like I said, like this is not what they you don't learn this in med school. You learn like oxidative phosphorylation and nice. Nice. And then yeah, sorry, name drop. I hate myself.
I'm impressed. No, listen, yeah. you had us at oxidative phosphorylation. That's pretty hot.
It's gonna be the name of my first child.
OP. You call him OP. That's a good name. When you're on call in the hospital, if you have like a system where your ER has an on-call toxicologist, I'm assuming that's home call, which means they'll call you, you can stay at home and they'll call you and you answer things. You probably don't usually have to go in for those things, right?
Yeah, there are some cases that I do go in for. And if I think that the patient can benefit by having me at the bedside, then absolutely. So it really depends. I mean, in fellowship and even where I currently work, I've chose to live relatively nearby the hospital because I anticipate coming in. I also understand what it's like to be on the emergency doctor side of things. That I like when, if I'm consulting someone and I want them to come in, I like knowing that it's an option, right? And so I kind of have a little bit of perspective as someone who consults from the ED and then now as someone who consults to the ED. So yeah, a lot of the times though, if the case is relatively straightforward, I mean, like, you know, we run a talk service, we see the patients, but it ultimately depends. There are some nights where I am in the hospital and then just I sleep in the call rooms because it's been very busy. And other times where I'm doing home call and it's relatively okay. But now that I just said that, my next call for the next like 6 months is gonna be wild. thanks to you. So
yeah, sorry about that, man. But it builds character. So let me ask you, I know this is going to be hard to answer because there's probably such a variety, but what are the things, what's your bread and butter? What's like the stuff you get called on the most? I'm assuming ingestions.
Yeah. So, the most common things would be concern for a drug overdose or drug toxicity. And so the reason I specify those two as being a little bit different is so overdose, and I notice how I didn't say intentional or unintentional. I just kind of put them in the same category. An intentional overdose, and sometimes you can have an intentional overdose without the intent to self-harm. So it gets a little bit complicated. So I'm trying to use the correct word. So you can have any sort of overdose, intentional or unintentional. And so that can be someone taking a bunch of medications with the goal of self-harm. It can be someone who's taking a bunch of medications because they misunderstood how to take their medications, or there is confusion about how to take the medications. It can be unintentional, as in a child gets into something that they shouldn't, or something is, you know, especially like those pill counter or the
sure right box. The weekly pill boxes
take 2 days, you know, things like that. Any sort of concern for drug toxicity. So again, this can be in the context of I'll use a great example. So for some patients who are on digoxin, say a heart medication, certain antibiotics can actually cause your digoxin levels to go up, simply just taking them, because there are some bacteria that exist in our GI tract that normally chew up digoxin. But then when you take these antibiotics, you kill them off, and then you aren't chewing up that digoxin anymore, so you actually get more absorbed, and it can lead to digoxin toxicity. And so, again, that's not an overdose, right? That's just people like taking a medication for a UTI or a diverticulitis or something. So concern for drug toxicity, concern for withdrawal, like alcohol withdrawal, or benzodiazepine withdrawal, things like that. And then I think we have a lot of this sort of vague, this patient, is this tox, is a question we sometimes get asked. As in, someone is not acting as people think they should and want to know if there is a substance on board. And we actually in toxicology have a secret magic wand that we can wave, and it just tells us what it is. So we don't share that with people. We might need to edit that out, because I don't want people knowing.
You'll get know that. No, I got you. I got you on that
wand that we have. But no, so sometimes it's just to give a second set of eyes, and, you know, say, hey, is there anything you want to add? Do you think this could be tox related? Does this look like a toxidrome that you're experienced with it? And a lot of the, you know, sometimes I'm like, absolutely, this is great. And other times I'm like, I'm not sure either. So it's fine.
They're looking for reassurance. I'm assuming a lot. That's probably a lot of what you do.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think it does depend. And I think I sometimes have to remind myself that during fellowship, I did 2 years of rigorous toxicologic training. And so I think sometimes I have learned that the things that I take for granted, sometimes I'm like, oh, wait, I have more to offer than I thought, right? Like, you know, if someone's like, hey, does this patient have serotonin syndrome? Or do you think, and I'm, you know, I look at them and I'm being able to be like, actually, no, none of this really fits, can be like, oh, that was very helpful, thank you. And I'm like, oh, I'm glad I could help, right? You know, so I think I need to acknowledge sometimes what I've learned and have a little bit more confidence that I can bring something when I feel like I'm not. But no, it's been good. And I love working with my colleagues. I love the collegial and camaraderie approach to medicine. So it's very fun. And it's a nice change of pace from being the emergency doc to being a consultant.
Yeah. Tema, this is the thing, because you're going to be practicing in a field where you're going to have to call consultants for things. And these are consultants who have spent dedicated years to this particular topic. And you're going to have to deal with people like Josh and I, being like, oh, you didn't know about the oxidative phosphorylation pathway, CB3. You know, you'll have to deal with a lot of that. I mean, I don't know what advice to give you on that, other than just to, you know, wish them the best and turn the other cheek, because it's just not worth the hate. But you're going to, that's a big part of like consultants, is we have to always remember, yeah, there's a reason they're calling us for this. You know, we don't. We specifically went into training for this question. But that being said, this is an outsider's perspective on the ER, Josh. You, and I'm sure there's going to be like ER doctors listening to this, screaming at their phone, listening to this, wherever they listen to this. But I feel like there are certain things ER doctors are more likely to call out consultants for. Like if there's some cardiac issue, if there's some GI issue, they call us a lot for those things, and as they should. I feel like, is there some more ownership for ER doctors about toxicology things? Are they a little bit less willing to call out for that? Like they feel like, oh, this is my lane, I should know this. Is that something you experience?
It super depends on where you're training and where you're practicing, or where you trained and where you're practicing. So for example, when I was in residency, we didn't have a toxicology consult. That didn't exist. We just didn't have that. But we could always call poison control. Mm-hmm. And I treated a lot of patients with alcohol withdrawal when I was a resident, an emergency resident. And I just thought that was just what you do as an ER doc. And it is. And then when I started fellowship, I moved to a different state. And when I started fellowship, one of the first consults I got on tox was for alcohol withdrawal. And I remember talking to my attending, and I was like, "Oh my, OMG, get this!" I was like, "Someone called us for an alcohol withdrawal," and they were like, "Yeah," they were like, "Okay," and I was like, "Oh, that wasn't the response I expected." And I was like, and I was like, "Oh, I mean, yeah, that's like a normal thing we get, right?" And they were like, "Absolutely," and I was like, "Yeah, totally." So it like I didn't know, and so it's very it totally depends. Like I didn't know until I started fellowship that people called about alcohol withdrawal. I thought that was just an emergency medicine thing, and then now as I'm getting elsewhere, I realize that I actually toxicologists have so much to add in the management and in helping with alcohol withdrawal. And I was like, oh man, I look back to residency and I wonder if, you know, that by having, if we had a toxicology consult or something, like if that could have helped more of our patients. We just didn't know what we didn't have. And so it really depends. So I have had people call me to ask questions that I feel like are super, super advanced. And I'm like, oh, did you do a tox fellowship? Because you know this in and out. And then I've had people call and ask questions that are like, hey, like, how do I give naloxone again? And then I'm like, oh, like, I know med students who are getting trained on this and probably know this as well. So it's huge variation. And again, my personal approach as a consultant is this might just be a little bit of my personality, but I don't ever yell, and I don't try to make anyone feel dumb or silly, because my approach is that if you're calling someone for help or to ask a question, you're doing it for the patient, right? Like, and I don't think there's ever a reason to be mean. And there's definitely been times at like 2 a.m. where I've been yelled at by a physician over the line for consulting them when I was in residency, and that feels horrible. Yeah. And so I never want to make anyone feel that way.
You know, I think it's an interesting conversation. The consultant and the person asking the consultant questions, because there's a lot of things that go into this. It's late at night, oftentimes, a person's sleeping, they're woken up. I will say personally, I like what your framework for this, and I think it's a really good one, which is like they're doing this for the patient's benefit. So it's hard to be angry about that. I'll be honest with you, the only times I don't love a phone call is when the ER doctor either knows already what they're going to do and what's right, but they just want to have it signed off that they talk to GI. And sometimes that's okay. And sometimes I'm just like, you didn't need to. You knew it. You just want to have something in the chart that protects you. And you didn't need that. It's unnecessary. It's a medical legal sort of framework that I don't think is a great practice. Yeah. Or when they're calling for a chart biopsy, which means that like, they're like, hey, it's like 2 a.m. in the morning. This person's having this issue. And then you look and they're basically asking you to help dissect the chart and look and see when their last endoscopy or colonoscopy was. Those are the things that I'm like, I don't love that. Don't love that. I feel like you could have done that. So I think that is a great framework that you have. And I think if you have that and you keep that, it's going to serve you really well.
I think what breaks my heart the most is being a consultant. I've only been a consultant for like, you know, 2 or 3 years now, is that everyone always apologizes when they call you. They're like, hey, you know, thanks for getting back to me. I'm like, why are you apologizing? I'm literally getting paid to be on call. It's like my job. Like I wasn't like, you know, yeah. Like, and so, but like, it is very interesting how everyone like apologizes, and it's not just here. Even when I was a fellow, people were like, hey, sorry, like and I'm like, what, like that, like I don't, and
no,
I
think listen, that so don't, that's
getting like grilled by the person who's on the other line, and I'm like, who hurt you? Like
that's not gonna be the case forever. That's not gonna be the case forever. Like I got a call, like some of the ER people get hardened, so they stop like being apologetic. Like I got a call like at 3 a.m. the other night, and they're like, hey, I just want to give you a heads up on this patient. Here's the MRN number, here's the medical records. You can put this into the computer. I'm like, it's 3 a.m. You think I'm sitting in front of a computer? I'm like, what are you doing? Like, what? I'm like, that's not how it works. And no. So like there can be a hardening of the ER doctors where they're like, purposely will just be like, yeah. No, I'm going to just call this and it's my right. And I get it. It's survival at that point. They have to do that. But you enjoy those pleasant exchanges.
I just think why can't people just be nice to each other? I mean, like I called someone recently on one of my shifts, a consultant, and I said, I was like, hey, dude, I do not know what this is. And I was like, can you help me out? And they're very nice. And they said, hey, for future reference, like, if I see this again, like, you know, would you mind telling me, like, how would I take care of this in the future? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, like, have a good conversation. I understand everything. And sometimes if you're bouncing between like 9 consults, but like I usually there's been times where like a hospital or something has kept me up the entire night, but like that's the gig, right? I mean, like I didn't come into toxicology to never be called or only be called between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. right? Like, I mean, like at the end of the day, if my family member was in the hospital and someone was calling a consultant with a question about them, I would want there to be some collegiality. And so again, like maybe I'm being a little bit too much of a softy, but I really just don't think there's any room for sort of shitty behaviors by either the consulting or the consultants, just because we all know that it's like, it's hard to approach people when they're assholes.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And that can just lead to more barriers. I don't know. The one thing I'll say, and then I'll shut up, is I remember in med school there was this attending in the operating room that was like notorious, like threw shit, yelled at everyone, whatever. And one time when I was a med student, this attending in the OR broke sterile fields. Very clearly their arm like touched something it shouldn't have, and no one in the room said anything. And I was like, yo, like I was like, I remember thinking like, wait, I gaslit myself and I was like, did he break sterile wheel? Maybe he didn't. And then I was like, nope. Like, you know, there was multiple residents. There was, I think, a chief there. There was like the scrub tech, everyone, no one said a word because they were like, we would rather let this person break sterile field, put the patient theoretically at higher risk and not get yelled at by this person. So I know that these people being assholes puts up barriers, and I don't know if we appreciate that as much, because people will also often like to defend and say, oh, they're like really mean, but they're really good doctor. And I'm like, yeah, but like,
what if you were nice? Be nice and a good doctor?
Yeah, I mean, like, then you get the best of both worlds, like hashtag Hannah Montana. Like, what are you like? I don't know. So anyways, that's my spiel. Anyways, I did talk to my resident afterwards, and I was like, well, did everyone notice what happened? Like, was I wrong? Like, cause I think it was like early on in the OR, I didn't really understand anything. And afterwards they were like, oh no, definitely that happened. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, oh wait. Oh, so we just didn't say anything. They're like, oh my God, he yells so much. And I was like, oh, okay. It was disheartening. Anyways, I apologize. I'm talking a lot.
it's so interesting hearing y'all talk about it from like the med student side. Because I wish more consultants knew that if a med student is calling you, we did not want to.
Oh, yeah.
We were being forced.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because there have been so many times where they're like, do you want to call the consultant? And I'm like, no. And they're like, you're calling them. And I'm like, and then afterwards I'm shaking. And I'm like, hi.
It's like a very advanced level skill to call a consultant. And because you have to be able to synthesize all of the information you got succinctly and then present it to like in a package framed in a way that's relevant to the, like, these are like advanced level skills to be able to do that. Like, it's hard.
Yeah.
On one of my sub-eyes, I had to present an ICU patient, which is already not great, who was going through multi-system organ dysfunction. And I was like, sir, I'm going to apologize up front because I know this is going to be a mess. And he's like, it's okay. Let's go through this together. But that was a chef's example because he knew what we were both going to be struggling. But a lot of times it's very much like, what do you want? Get to it. And I'm like, I'm a child. Please take pity.
Oh gosh, I don't know. You're going to be fine, and you'll learn those skills as you get further, and you'll learn to, I guess, identify people who the consultants and the teams that you know are more approachable and whatnot. I remember when I was a fellow, I got called by an intern in one of the hospitals asking me a tox question, whatever. And there was this long pause and he goes, hey, you're an attending, right? And I was like, yes. And he's like, you graduated residency, right? And I was like, yes. And he's like, can I just like ask you some questions about like my other patients that are like kind of medicine related? And I was like, I was like, don't you have someone you can call for that? And he was like, yeah, but they're like really mean. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, like, I can help you out, dude, but like, I don't think I could be your entire team consult.
Dude, Josh, this is the thing though, okay? Because I am your ghost of Christmas future. When you're known as the attending that people can come talk to, you know, and that you're not going to give them a hard time, especially, I'm especially benign to medical students and residents because I feel for them. But the problem then is then you're known for that and you're going to get consults when you're not on call. And you'll be like, why are you calling me right now? Yeah. The X and such is on call. I don't want to deal with that. Yeah. And I'll be like, I get it. Because sometimes it's like, you just want to be able to talk to someone without feeling like an idiot. And doctors are great at making people feel like idiots. It's like part of our fucking training is to learn how to make people feel like stupid, both patients and other doctors. It's a horrible part of our like culture, and I don't know what to do about that. But I think it's a fascinating topic, and it's something that is deeply ingrained in medical training.
Ooh, something I noticed on my sub-eyes. I don't know if y'all have your like medical toxicologist conferences, but do you notice that certain areas of the country deal with more stuff than the other? And I asked that because when I was in California, I saw a rattlesnake bite for the first time. And I was freaking out, as one does, because rattlesnake. All the family docs and ER docs over there were like, this is very normal. They're like, we always get rattlesnake bites, especially, I guess, on like military installations.
Yeah.
Great question. Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a regional variability in sort of what you get. I've definitely moved around a little bit over the past few years, and the things that I was so used to seeing in residency, just in my training from a tox standpoint, are not what I see currently, and vice versa. And then talking to my friends in like Arizona, they're like, yeah, you just, you know, make sure you tap your shoes out for scorpions. And I'm like, what? it's different, interesting, and that, so it can either be environmental differences. So for example, you're going to have more snakes and scorpions in some areas. There's certain mushrooms that we worry about, like in the Pacific Northwest, that we wouldn't necessarily worry about in other areas of the country. Different sort of exposure you get to certain plants, just the geographic variation. And then there's also variation in substances that people use recreationally. And so some places are very big areas that have more like methamphetamines. Other places are areas that tend to have more like heroin or fentanyl. Other places are more, you know, sometimes people will put it like party drugs. It just totally depends. I mean, like, I don't think I have heard some docs who have called me and say, well, this is strange, we don't normally get this out here. I'm like, well, you do now. Like, like it found its way out there. Like, so I think it really depends. And there's, I think, just with the, not to get on my soapbox, but I think just with the internet and a lot of our social media applications and sort of social or our app purchasing that we can do, a lot of things can find their ways to places they wouldn't be previously. And so, like, I know, like, when I was in a major city, you could literally Grubhub whippets, like whippet canisters, whipped cream canisters, which people can use recreationally. You could just, like, order those and be like, yes, I am having we are making lots of whipped cream here at 2 a.m. lots of it. Like, please deliver now. And so, like, again, it was like, it just depends. But yes, there is definitely that variation. And it's one thing you have to keep in mind when you're doing, like, a tox fellowship. Like, where do you want to try? Like, if you really, really, really love snakes and scorpions and stuff like that, you're probably going to want to go someplace like the Southwest.
All right. With our limited time, I think we should shift over to listener questions. We've got quite a few of them. We've covered some of the topics already. A lot of these are multi-part questions, so I'm just going to leave out some of the parts because I'm just going to cover a few of these. Let's start with Heather Eleanorain at Med-Mastodon. One, there are obvious toxins, then not so well-known over-the-counter drugs that can easily be taken in toxic amounts. I think we're all thinking of Tylenol when we hear that, acetaminophen. What are the lesser-known substances that people don't think of as being dangerous? That's part one of that question. What would you say for that?
Very frequently, I'm treating patients for acetaminophen toxicity that had no clue. It's like over the counter, right? Mm-hmm. My personal belief is that if acetaminophen were to go through the drug approval process nowadays, it would not make it through, just because it is, the toxicity can be really frustrating because you're relatively asymptomatic during the time that you would want to treat someone. And so unless you're thinking about it, it can be easily missed.
Sometimes people come in and the test is negative. So it's one of those things that you have to have a low threshold to treat with, it is a tricky one. I agree.
And it's in everything too. I think a while back I did a Twitter thread, just like trying to list all the OTC things, comments, preparations that acetaminophen or Tylenol can be in, just because it's so much. So if you tell someone, take your Tylenol, take your Percocet, take your, you know, cold and cough medicine, you're getting a lot of Tylenol exposure. It's in a lot of things. So aside from acetaminophen, though, say some of the concerning things that I've seen that are over the counter that I've seen patients get very, very sick or die from, diphenhydramine is 100% up there, Benadryl, simply because it has some cardiac toxicity manifestations that can be quite dangerous and can cause patients to get very, very sick. And again, you know, if you go on TikTok or wherever, people love to talk about their Benadryl challenge or things that they're doing. And if you know, which again, like the toxicologists are like pulling their hair out with how frustrating that can be. So Benadryl is definitely up there. Then we mentioned acetaminophen, aspirin. Again, when I was a kid, it was like, just you have a headache, take an aspirin. Or, you know, it's a very, people think of it as like a relatively benign pain medicine. And oh, your daily aspirin is good. Aspirin toxicity is very dangerous and very unpleasant. And these patients can get very sick very quickly, simply by the symptoms that it can cause from a metabolic acidosis standpoint. And then it can be very, very dangerous. So aspirin, again, is something that worries me. Caffeine, I mean,
How dare you?
I know, I'm sorry. We'll take that out.
I'm totally editing that part out.
Yeah. Caffeine, certainly. And this isn't just like drinking your cups of coffee. Side note, when I was studying for tests in college, I think I became gently caffeine toxic because I remember one day I had 9 cups of, no, what? I had 10 cups of coffee and a croissant.
What? Listen, man, after the third cup, you gotta stop.
I know what was wrong.
Getting anywhere.
That croissant was good, but like it was just it was just like, yeah, the croissant was really good. I think it's because like I was having like some like hemorrhagic gastritis or something at that point. It was like just like soaking it up with a croissant. But so
I do love coffee. I love coffee. I'm a coffee guy, but there, I mean, I don't know the details of, there's some health benefits of coffee. We've actually done an episode about that, but it's not a completely benign substance. It can have issues. I don't know if there's actual evidence behind this. I'm curious, but I feel like I've seen in college when people were, because I was in college to study, people were taking caffeine pills. That was like, that was like something they would come around campus with. People would have samples of caffeine pills. And I knew one of my suite mates went into like a brief mania because he was popping too many of them. Like, I don't know, maybe that was just an underlying thing. Maybe it was the stress of what we were going through with finals. It was really, you know, competitive and scary at that time. Maybe that was it. But I definitely felt like it could unlock something pretty bad. I wonder if that's proven, like a caffeine induced mania or something.
Well, I feel like that caffeine can certainly cause some euphoria, right? I mean, like just that that sort of feeling. And so caffeine, the reason I bring caffeine up is because it's not just coffee, but those like pills, like a no-dose. Yeah. Like one. Right. Yeah. And like there's a lot of different caffeine pills. People generally take them by mouth. Sometimes people find other ways to take
them. Do people boof coffee? Oh, they do. I know that. I know it's coffee enemas. You know what boofing is?
This is why we're here. So boofing is the act of placing drugs into the anus, into the rectum for it's kind of like the way you would snort a drug. Sometimes when people are snorting a drug, their nose gets too irritated or something like that. They don't want to inject. You can sort of shove it up your butt to get absorbed in that way.
I just never knew there was a specific term for it.
Yes, it's called boofing. Wow. People would like blow. You know, if your buddies like, would you mind blowing this cocaine up my butthole? You'd be like, yes, of course.
That's what friends do. I only know about it because of Brett Kavanaugh and his boofing of alcohol during like his college years.
That's butt chugging.
Yeah. You guys call it butt chugging. But back in the day, they called it boofing, I guess.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So you know, when it comes to caffeine, I think it can be one of those things that people don't realize, again, kind of like acetaminophen, it's gonna be in your energy drink, it's gonna be in your coffee, your pills, whatever. And people will take them either for, you know, losing weight or for wanting to study or do all these things. And it can be a bit dangerous. I mean, essentially it you know, causes your heart rate to speed up. What's very interesting about this class of medication, so caffeine is something called a methylxanthine, that these drugs act as adenosine antagonists. And so, which is very interesting, we don't have a lot of things that do that. And so people can go into sort of like these heart rhythms that are really, really fast and like SVT, and some of our drugs that we use to manage that, like adenosine, won't work because caffeine and other methylxanthines are adenosine antagonists. So it's very interesting. But so that one's not a great one. Don't love those caffeine toxicity or caffeine overdoses.
Mm-hmm.
Dextromethorphan, DXM, very not my favorite thing for patients to get toxic with. And then any sort of supplements or things you can find that are unregulated. My 1-2 sentence spiel on supplements, I'll say, is that in the world of supplements that you can get in like your Duane Reade or CVS or Walgreens or whatever, there is not a lot of very little regulation that goes into what is in these products. And I have had patients have undesired compounds or things in their supplements before that have caused harm, or we are concerned that caused harm, simply because these aren't regulated the same way that like your antibiotics and
mm-hmm.
other pharmaceuticals are. That's
a good list. That's a good list. It's not the board's, Josh.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't have to give me everything. Jeez, you're too good at this. You're too good at this. Okay,
keep going. I apologize.
We have more listener questions to get to. People have so much they want to learn from you.
Sorry.
let's go through a couple more. I actually have one for Tema too, here in the listener questions. Yeah, I know, prepare yourself. Okay, so Karen Percy at Karen Percy One has a couple of questions. We covered some of them. Let me go to part three of her question. What is the first thing you should do if someone is altered from what you think is a poison or a drug? This is for you, Josh. Yeah.
The first thing you should do, well, I guess the question depends on where you're located. Like if this is in a, like, is this a lay person? Is this a hospital? I'll say,
this is a lay person. This is a lay person at home. They walk across their friend who hasn't been answering the phone, and they knock on their door, and they bang, and they see their friend lying on the couch, sort of incapacitated, and a bottle of something that they don't really know what it is lying next to them.
I will say the things you shouldn't do first are going to be, don't shove your hands down their throat to make them throw up. Don't pour milk down their throat as some attempt to, sometimes people think that can, there's a lot of things about milk that don't make the child to me. There's no super secret tox thing I'm going to tell you. This is just going to be your standard, like, you check for a pulse, you call 911, you initiate CPR if that's something that you feel comfortable doing, or and honestly, if they don't have a pulse and you don't feel comfortable doing it, it might be worth, when you talk to like 911, for example, they'll walk you through it. But there's no secret special things. I think sometimes people think like, oh, this person overdosed on something, and what was it? I just watched some TV show where they like just held the person over the toilet and forced emesis them by like sticking their hands down their throat. And I was like, no, like if you try and make someone who's not protecting their airway like force throw up, they'll just aspirate it, and you'll, if anything, probably contribute to their demise faster. So we don't really. Like that. No, there's no super secret tox things here. This is just sort of your standard approach to an unresponsive person is you're checking for a pulse, you call 911, and then you're sort of going through the motions of, do they need CPR, et cetera. In the hospital setting, again, if this is, you walk into a room for a patient that you're in the ED and you're going to go see them or something, and they're unresponsive and you're suspicious for something tox, then you're going to be defaulting to your do they have a pulse? Yes or no. And then your ABCs, your airway, breathing, circulation, right? Again, there is no super secret tox.
But I think that's a really good point that you bring from a GI perspective as well. You know, if someone has swallowed something caustic and you're worried it might be affecting their like esophagus or their stomach, you do not want to make them vomit it up, because then you're exposing them to it again. And there's the risk of aspiration. I will say this though about milk. There was a pediatric gastroenterology journal that showed that when someone did swallow a battery, a kid swallows a battery, as you had mentioned, that's really dangerous, because the what can happen is the lining of the mucosa can start to burn through and it can perforate because of that battery. It can basically be activated. So you do want to get those out soon. There was this one study that came out not long ago showing that people giving them milk and honey actually helped slow that down. So it's still definitely worth calling the poison center for. But yeah, you're right. I've heard of people trying to pour like things like milk down people's throats when they're not when they're obtunded or they're not really clear. That can be really dangerous. So don't recommend that. Okay. Great answer again. Okay. Let's go to Drav Bhagavan. Sorry, buddy. At Drav Bhagavan. And he has a multi-part one for you and then one for Tema. Let's start with the one for Tema. How does FM, family medicine, versus FMOB work with respect to training and practice? And why did you choose this path?
Yeah, so family medicine in the US, at least, three-year specialty, like for residency, some programs do four, but mostly it's 3 years, and you get like that full spectrum like primary care. So when people think of like the town doctor that used to exist, that's family medicine. FMOB, which not as many people seem to know about, is basically just getting more of that like OB training. So a lot of FMOBs are actually able to do C-sections, basically like relatively uncomplicated C-sections, or are able to do like first assist. for a lot of them. So a lot of people who go down that FMOB route, it's because they do like the obstetrics. It's just they didn't want to do OB-GYN. Like for me, I really love obstetrics. I really love like deliveries. I love C-sections. I just didn't care for gyn surgery at all, to be honest. So FMOB kind of gave me the best of both worlds, where I'll be able to do all the primary care, and then if I have a patient, I'll be able to deliver them if I want to. If they have a C-section, they need a C-section and it's relatively uncomplicated, I could probably like do the C-section myself or be first assist for it, and just get that like full care, take care of them, take care of baby, take care of like whole family. Yeah. So for FMOB, some programs are designated that they don't have, you don't have to do a fellowship afterwards because you get so much OB training during it. But for the most part, if you don't go to a program like that, you just do like a 1-year fellowship afterwards and then you are an FMOB.
Oh yeah, that's a good plug. I like it. I mean, best of both worlds. It's like when people ask me why I do GI, I mean, that's one of the reasons. You want to be able to do something where it's sort of like cerebral, but you can do something procedural and you feel like you've really done something at the same time. No, that's a good sell for that. Okay, here is one of Drove's questions for you though, Josh. He had multiple ones, but they might be too high level for me. So I'm going to ask this one. What is your favorite fumigant?
It's funny when people ask these questions, because at first you're like, why would anyone have a favorite fumigant? But then obviously I do. So, I'd say in general, I don't like most of the fumigants. I think if I had to choose one, I'd probably say... there is a fumigant called methylbromide, and it's one of those ones that's got a little bit of history that's kind of interesting. Sometimes you'll see when people are getting like these fumigation tents over over a building or something. But again, they're all of the fumigants are very toxic. I think the thing that I like about methylbromide is it's got some history. It used to be used as a old fire extinguisher back before we realized that you shouldn't extinguish fires with things that could also kill people. So we don't use that anymore. It has this sort of a sweet chloroform odor, if you will. Not that I know what that smells like or that I would recommend going and smelling that.
I love that you're a connoisseur of things that can kill you. That's fantastic.
Instead of like tossing the wine around and sipping, it's just
let's
pour four notes.
Okay, two more questions and then we're gonna close up shop here. Okay. This one is from Charismatic Megafauna at CMJOMGLOL. That's pretty funny, actually. This one is, can you talk about xylazine? I would love to hear about clinical presentation, mechanisms, complications, and management. You don't need to go into all that, but could you tell people what xylazine is and what it does?
Sure. So if I were going to sum up xylazine. So xylazine is it's a drug that's used for sedation and analgesia, and like usually in the animal world, and veterinarians use it a lot. And I think I've obviously never really given xylazine. I'll say the long story short with xylazine is that it is a central alpha 2 agonist, and it basically can cause you to have, in humans, can cause some central nervous system depression, some bradycardia, some hypotension, and can sometimes cause very, very, very bad drowsiness. And it is 100% not safe for humans, obviously. Sometimes it's found its way into certain drugs. It's been some sort of contaminant in things like fentanyl and heroin. And if you're interested in hearing more, reading more about that, the FDA has put out a health alert about xylazine, just to healthcare professionals. I believe if you were to Google FDA health alert and xylazine, you would see it. But it's just something to think about in these patients. If you ever see something like this again, if someone calls me, xylazine is not like, did you check for xylazine? It's not going to be something I'm going to ask. It's more of like something we keep in the back of our heads when we're thinking about weird things.
Got you. I actually hadn't heard of it until this question. That's when the first time I looked it up. So I'm kind of curious to know if this is something that people are seeing, if this is like a real issue.
Well, it's not like something that we can have I potentially seen it before? Possibly, but you know, there's not a bedside xylazine test we're doing in the emergency department. And right. If someone comes in and I'm concerned that this may have been exposure, I'll treat them appropriately. There's no super secret xylazine antidote that we give, right? And so it's just going to be supportive care. And then if they get better, I think the what we would tell them is to not
do xylazine again.
Not to get exposed to the thing that happened in the first place. So how much are we seeing? Well, it's hard to say because we're not testing every single
gotcha.
Thing.
Gotcha.
Right? So
no, it's good to know about it. Tema, I will give you $5 if you drop that at around at some point. Be like, have we considered xylazine?
Potential ingestion of xylazine? Yes.
That's pretty good.
I haven't heard. Yeah.
Okay, last question. Last question. This is from Rashid Altafi. That's Rashid_Altafi. He's down in Corona, California. This is what he asks. Interested to know more about adverse effects of psilocybin in relation to treatment of major depression. So psilocybin, mushrooms, we hear about it a lot now in terms of treatment for anxiety or depression, PTSD, I've heard it. You know, like any other drug, there is going to be some adverse effects that you might see. Is this something that you've encountered or been called about, Josh?
I'll be honest, I have not encountered this. I've encountered patients using mushrooms, but never with this intent. And I know this is an active area of study, but I don't think I can comment too much on the use of the side effects from use in these studies where they're sort of testing it out. I've seen patients, and I have treated patients who have claimed that they thought they were using psilocybin, right? I mean, like I don't go and you know go over to their place and look at the mushroom and like you know, I was like, okay. So I don't have a ton of experience in that realm. I apologize.
What do you do when your friends call you and they're like, we did mushrooms and we are just tripping balls too hard?
Oh my. Well, I say, I'm here for you and I love you and I care about you. And speaking of my very calming yet noxious stimuli voice that I have, and I tell people it's going to be okay. But I think in general, no one really knows a lot of these things. Like when it comes to the world of mushrooms, it's not like everyone's a mushroom expert. Every now and then, a friend from college who I haven't talked to in like 10 years will text me and it'll just be a picture of a mushroom and it'll just be safe. And I'm like,
no, no.
Well, hello. It's nice to chat with you again. So no, I think I haven't had a ton of my friends doing random shrooms. Thankfully,
we have different friends is what I'm hearing here. Okay. This has been great. Fantastic. We have to close this down. Before we do that, though, let me get your guys' plugs. Tema, where can people find you?
Y'all can find me on Twitter, Tema Fudge, like the chocolate. Same on Instagram. You know, I'm just here.
Yeah, I mean, if you're posting pictures of your trip, it's worth following. So follow her on Instagram. She does post great pictures, and she's awesome to follow on Twitter again. It's really great to have seen you again, Tema. Thank you so much for joining us at like 3 a.m. or whatever it is in Singapore. Have safe travels, please, okay?
I will. Thank you.
Josh, where can people find you?
Twitter as well. For now, it's at J Trebach. It's just my last name, TREBACH. And then my second plug will be, if you find yourself with a poison question or whatever, you can always call your local poison control center.
I do recommend following Josh while he's on Twitter, at least, and then following him to whatever platform he goes to next. Tons of great tutorials. Really fun. He does this really fun thing where like he'll post some murder mystery thing where like a patient comes in, a baker comes in, found down, what was it, you know, and then he'll kind of go through the case and he'll post pictures of plants and be like, should you eat this? And the answer is always no. So, but it's really worthwhile doing. So I highly recommend it. Guys, I have no reason to say this because I had nothing to do with it, but I'm exceedingly proud of both of you and what you have done so far in your careers. I'm super excited to see what both of you continue to do. And it's really been great having you on. Thank you both so much for coming on.
Of course, thank you.
Thank you to Nadine for help with production, and thank you to Lucky Dog Hot Sauce. I highly recommend checking out Lucky Dog Hot Sauce at luckydoghotsauce.com. Bye, guys. Love you. Mwah, 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 mwah.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to save. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.